Support for the Capital Connection comes from
United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. And New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
The Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is one of my favorite people in all of politics, New York State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli. Welcome back, Tom. It's always great to see you here.
Always great to be back with you, and I hope never to lose that honorific of being one of your favorites. So thank you, Alan. A mutual appreciation for everything you and your team does at the station. I love being in Albany because I get to listen to you guys, so keep up the great work.
I'm going to tell you something you may not know. You can listen to WAMC.org anywhere in the world. And I have. So you don't have to wait to get to Albany. You just have to take your little device out and just put it in there, you know.
Yeah, but Alan, I'm older than you. I don't know how to do that kid stuff, you know. I mean, I'm old-fashioned. Just give me the radio that I could crank up when I'm in the exact service area. That's what I do.
You're older than 81? That's not possible. Okay, so here we go. Let's have some fun here. Let me ask you, number one, how are our finances in New York State? We doing well, or are we above the board or below the board or whatever?
Yeah, well, let me answer it this way. You know, certainly as we've continued to report, tax collections have been strong. Budget seems to be holding together nicely. The State Division of Budget put out the updated financial plan, which projects into the future and shows budget balance for a number of years to come. But that being said, there's great volatility out there. And I think the situation is changing, not necessarily for the better. So, you know, we're going to have probably in a week or so, maybe less, our updated cash report. We'll see whether some of the positive trends we've seen start to go the other way. You know that the inflation number coming out this week again shows historic high inflation. That has an impact. The Fed, you know, acting again on interest rates, that's having an impact. New York City this week just put out a projection that the estimated income tax payments are down by about a third because of losses in capital gains. So I guess what I'm saying, Alan, is, what we've been seeing thus far as we've headed into July, the numbers seem to be holding together. But we see a lot of negative trends popping up that could reverse, you know, what has been a strong situation, which is why when we commented on the state financial plan, we said you need to be cautious. There are risks there. We acknowledged that the governor and the legislature made a commitment to build up our rainy day funds, our reserve funds, to be prepared for when there's an economic downturn. But, my recommendation in our analysis is they need to accelerate how quickly we build up those funds, because that rainy day may be happening a lot sooner than some of us had anticipated. So, bottom line, you know, we've been fine, but there are a lot of negative trends that seem to be coming to play here, and that rainy day we've been warning about may be coming a little sooner than we had hoped.
Now, I just heard the word inflation. What's happening with our inflation in New York, and is it different from other places?
Well, I mean, there's always regional variances. I know the numbers just came out this week. I haven't seen a breakdown of the regional variances yet. Actually, on some measures, believe it or not, the New York City metro area has been a little less in some categories than some other parts of the country. But I think it's fair to say we're not an outlier. I mean, we're pretty close to what, you know, the numbers are, and that has implications obviously for New York households, but also for New York State. You know, in terms of our spending and buying goods and services. Just the most obvious thing that people are, you know, concerned about, gasoline. I mean, obviously the state has purchases there as well, so the state gets impacted just like everyday households get impacted. So that's absolutely going to be a concern. We're putting out the tax cap in a couple of days. We do that calculation, and I'm absolutely expecting that, you know, the inflation factor is going to push it to the max of 2%. So that's going to put more pressure on local government budgets. So, you know, it's going to continue to be a tough time, and a time for us all to be very cautious and conscious of our spending, and not assume that that these headwinds are going to abate anytime soon.
Tom DiNapoli, would you be kind enough to explain to all of us about the tax cap? What is it, and why is it so important?
Well, that was a law that came into effect a number of years ago that basically had the goal of limiting property tax increases. So there's a calculation that we make in the controller's office. It's called 2%, but that's really a piece of the calculation. It doesn't mean your taxes, you know, won't go up more than 2%. And with that tax cap, it's a little different than the tax cap, for instance, that Massachusetts has had and some other states have had. Local governments, meaning school districts and municipalities, they could go beyond the cap that's allowed, but they need a supermajority to exceed the cap. So it still retains for localities the option to, to set their budget and then, of course, the taxes that would follow. But it makes it harder to go beyond the state cap. And for school districts that vote, you know, in New York State, most school districts vote on their budget, but, you know, by the public, by voters, they have to get a supermajority, and that's often very hard to do. So when you look at the analysis of property tax trends in recent years, there seems to be no question that the tax cap in New York has moderated property tax increases. Hasn't stopped them, hasn't eliminated them, but the trajectory or the rate of increase has certainly slowed since the tax cap was implemented.
Now, one of the things that has annoyed me in the past is when they try to deal with your ability to pre-audit. And the New York Times has written the legislature's proposed budget would have restored to state statute some of the controller's pre-audit powers, which had been removed under Mr. Cuomo. Ms. Hochul's budget stripped it out. Now, why is Ms. Hochul basically, unless I'm reading this incorrectly, in the Cuomo camp?
Well, I think you basically summarized it accurately. I can't speak to the why part. But, you know, when we say pre-audit, what we're really talking about is the opportunity, which has existed for decades by statute, for the controller to review at the front end of a contract that the state would enter into to make sure that everything is appropriate, that good taxpayer value is involved. And what happened, as you point out, under the previous governor, with the support of the legislature, as part of budget negotiations on a couple of occasions, the ability for us to have that authority was watered down. It wasn't eliminated totally, but there were carve-outs, significant carve-outs, billions of dollars in SUNY and CUNY contracts, on centralized contracts through OGS, where you've had many billions of dollars worth of procurements. And there's been an interest, thankfully, on the part of many in the legislature and the good government groups to restore that. So that accountability is there, and to make sure that there's nothing going. You know, look, we've had a situation with the Buffalo Billion, and some of that involved, you know, entities created through SUNY and involving economic development money, entities that we were cut out of, you know, review. So, hey, no system is perfect, but you want to have as many eyes looking at these arrangements, these contracts before. One of the arguments has been, well, the controls office, when they review it, it takes too long, it becomes an efficient. Well, that's not really true. We have for like 95% of our reviews are done in a week or less. And if certainly something is urgent or emergency, we really expedite it. So, you know, that to me has always been a bogus argument. And I just think, you know, we need to be looking out for taxpayer interest. So, you know, as you point out, fast forward to where we're at today, the legislature voted to restore our authority in this area back to what it had been for decades. So it's not really a new authority. It's just really a restoration of that ability to look at the oil. Again, we call it pre-audit because you're looking at the contract ahead of time. The other argument is, well, they could look at it after the fact. Well, after the fact, if the money's been misspent, it's too late. Money's already out the door. That's why this is important. So the legislature voted to restore basically all of that authority that had been taken away. Overwhelmingly passed the Senate and Assembly. It's now before the governor. We don't have an indication yet whether she plans to sign it. I certainly hope that she would. It would be, I think, a strong message about, in fact, it's a new day as far as transparency and accountability in the state capitol.
Well, didn't she promise transparency when she, you know, was coming into office? She said things would be transparent. This doesn't smell that good.
Well, this piece, it's a piece of that discussion. I don't want to make it sound like it's, the only issue in terms of transparency and openness, because I do think that Governor Hochul has set a very different tone and a very different atmosphere. But I think, as you point out, the governor's created her own expectations in this area. And I think restoring the controller's oversight authority here will be viewed as a very key specific of what's really meant by a new day as far as transparencies. So I'm going to be, Alan, I'm always the optimist that the right thing's going to happen and she's going to sign it and we'll get back to where we were. And that to me would be the outcome that I would certainly hope for.
And if she doesn't sign it, will you yell at her?
I'm not a yeller, Alan. I yell at you and David once in a while, but I am not a yeller. No.
Well, we hear you're about to release the tax cap number. First of all, what is the tax cap, and can you share it with us?
Well, it's going to be at the 2% number. Because inflation's been low for so many years, we've been below the 2%, but it's going to be at 2% this time around, which is, kind of the maximum allowed.
Now, what about the stock market? Are we doing well? How about all your money? Are you being rewarded for your hard work?
Well, let's make clear it's not my money, Alan. This is the money of the pension fund that our employees contribute and our governments put in.
Yeah.
And then we make money by investing it. Well, we're still finalizing. I'm sure I'll have it later this month of July. The final numbers, because we value the fund on March 31st every year, and there's always a lag. We know what the stock market's doing, but we don't know what the real estate and private equity and the other holdings are. I believe we are going to meet and exceed our long-term goal of 5.9% positive return for the fiscal year ending March 31st. So that's the good news, because when this terrible invasion of the Ukraine happened in March, mid-March, the stock market went down and we took a bit of a hit there, but we're going to still end the year very, very good. The challenge is that June 30th, that end of that quarter, there's no doubt that it's a negative, going to be a negative number. Again, I don't have that number yet. It's too soon because we saw how the stock market really performed very, very poorly. And most of our investments, not all by any means, are in the stock market. So we're very much tied to that performance. So I guess the bottom line is, today we're going to be less than we were at the end of March. But the good news is, in terms of our, the number we use for our financial documents and our audited reports, that won't be updated till next March. So we've got time to make it back. That's good news. And the other important piece is, we went into this tough time over 99% funded. So for the pension fund, that means we're virtually fully funded. That means we're in a strong position. So that tells me, even if we have a short-term negative, we're going to be able to weather this. So the retirees that are listening to your show, they have nothing to worry about. We got plenty of money for them. And even the people who are working today, we're a strong fund. It's the person starting work today, that in a local government or for the state, it's those are the folks we're thinking about. How do we invest to secure their future? So it's a rockier time for investors right now. There's no doubt about it. But, hopefully as we move through this year, it'll settle out and we'll come next March 31st. We'll have another strong year.
Tom DiNapoli, you are, of course, the senior politician in New York State, one who I have noted over and over again how much respect I have for you. But there is now some redistricting hell out there with people running against each other. For example, Carolyn Maloney and Jerry Nadler are up against each other in the same district. What do you say around the breakfast table is going on?
Well, you say it's a mess, and it certainly would have been preferable if the legislature could have retained control of the process. It went, as you know, to the courts. The courts threw out the maps for the state Senate and Congress, kind of threw out the maps for the Assembly, but said they hope to deal with that till another time. And it went to an independent master. You know, there's some value, one might argue, in terms of an independent master, but you know, this fellow was a professor, no knock on professors, out of Pennsylvania, you know, probably did not fully get all of the local history, trends, you know, people. When the initial maps were put out, there was a fair amount of pushback, and the maps were changed again. But you did have a number of situations where communities are thrown together that have not been thrown together for a long time, if ever. And you do have a situation, you point out, you know, perhaps the most extreme one. We have two senior members of Congress, and New York needs senior members of Congress because it gives us more leverage, especially as we've lost yet another seat in our delegation as part of the census. Carolyn Maloney and Jerry Nadler, you know, really giants in New York State politics and key committee chairs in the House of Representatives, and they're running against each other. They're in the same district, so you have friends against friends. You have people that have been on the same side, you know, going against each other. You've got some of the same dynamic in some of the state Senate seats, and you have a primary in August. At the end of August, there was a low turnout for the June primary. I think everybody's projecting an even lower turnout in August. That's not great for the system. If you have few people making decisions, then in some of these districts, you know, winning the primary is tantamount to winning, sure, you know, the election. So it's created a lot of discomfort in political circles. Then you got that other district just south of not to focus just on the city, but that other district south of the Maloney Nadler district. I forget the new numbers, but you've got like 10, 12 people running, you know, from the former Mayor de Blasio, Mondaire Jones, who's Hudson Valley congressman running down there, Carlina Rivera from the city council, Yuli Nu from the assembly, Liz Holtzman, who I'm sure you interviewed times past, running again. Yeah, no, she's, you know, very important person in the state's history. Joanne Simon, a member of the Dan Goldman, who, you know, was involved with the impeachment. I'm sure I'm forgetting somebody because there are so many candidates there. I apologize if I didn't mention a name, but boy, do they have a lot to wade through in that district. So it's created a lot of complication, and that's unfortunate. What it really says, though, is that unfortunately, even with our efforts, and we had a constitutional amendment a couple of years ago on redistricting, we didn't quite get it right. For it to have to go to the courts and the courts to throw it out, it really created a lot of chaos, unfortunately. So hopefully when this year is done, everybody will kind of dust off the history books on this one and figure out a smarter way to get this done.
So I wanted to ask you about cybersecurity. New York State, you have found persistent shortcomings by local governments and school districts when it comes to cybersecurity. Is that really dangerous?
Yeah, there's no question about it. We've, you know, with our audits at the local government level, we've really taken cybersecurity as a key area of focus. When we do these audits, Alan, as opposed to the other audits where we, you know, we publish the findings, when we find gaps or shortcomings or deficiencies, we communicate them confidentially because we certainly don't want to identify what may be certain weaknesses that a school district or a village or a town may have. What we've also found is that many of the fixes that we recommend can be done without great cost. So it really is an opportunity to help local governments tighten up their cybersecurity. Why? Because they house a great deal of personal data about their employees. You don't want to see that breached. We've had instances where hackers have come in and attempted to, and in some rare cases with some success, transfer money out of accounts of school districts, taxpayer money. So this is an important area, and we all know that the environment we're living in, the hackers don't give up, and they're very smart. A lot of this comes from overseas. We see it in our own organization. Obviously, we, you know, have a lot of data that we maintain here at the controls office. It's a very high priority for us because the attempts to compromise our data are never ending, and it's the same thing for local government. So this is very much a priority area for us.
Now, we couldn't have you on without talking about the whole abortion issue right now. Now, does abortion and finance, your duties, have anything to do with each other? In other words, what should we be looking for here?
Well, in terms of the state role and payment role, obviously Medicaid in New York State is available for abortion services. New York State made that decision a long time ago. Remember, at the federal level, you had the Hyde Amendment, that said you could not spend federal money on abortions. New York has a very different position in that regard. And as you know, even prior to the Supreme Court decision, New York had strengthened its laws in this area. And even after it, the governor and legislature, again, strengthened the protections for people within New York, but also related to that, providing protections and support for women who may feel compelled now to come to New York because they can't access the reproductive health services in their own state. So, I think New York's history, which, Alan, as you can remember, our position on this question predates Roe v. Wade, right? So, when Nelson Rockefeller was governor, you had the reform, and Republican legislature, I might add, reformed the abortion laws way back prior to 73. So New York has a long history here of protecting women's autonomy and the right of women to make their own health care choices in this area. And it's very clear New York will continue to be a leading state to protect that right of privacy and that right of personal decisions.
Will that cost us money as a state?
To the extent that protecting that right, includes Medicaid funding, and you saw some effort to provide more money in the budget to support the clinics that are providing the service. Could there be some, nominal additional cost, perhaps? But I think that's a cost that New Yorkers would be very supportive of. I think that that most New Yorkers have felt very strong, whatever their personal opinion or choices as how they would approach the issue on abortion, that I think New York has a strong history of supporting a woman's right to choose in this area. So I don't think the cost would be anything that most people would question would outweigh the purpose, which is to protect what had been for 50 years constitutional right, and now the states, each state has to make its own determination in this area, until you have a future court that will probably make a different decision, but that's probably off for the future.
Well, this court is doing an awful lot that you've got to consider. I mean, when they come out with something like concealed carry, there's got to be a financial implication to that, doesn't there?
It's scary at every level. I mean, that was over 100-year-old law in New York State. We live in this era of horrendous gun violence. I mean, it's just, every day another mass shooting, and not that New York is immune from it, but the concealed carry, the Sullivan law, was a level of protection, I think. And in the face of all this, to overturn that, and again, this is another area, and I give credit to the governor and the legislature, they came back within the guidelines that are being interpreted that the Supreme Court put down to strengthen the regimen in this area in terms of people that want to seek a gun permit. So, you've already heard folks, what did I see in the paper, yesterday, Carl Palladino and others are going to challenge it in court. It's going to be back in the courts again. We'll see where it goes. But I think in New York, in response to the Supreme Court decisions, both on abortion and on concealed carry, the New York legislature stepping up and saying, well, if you're putting it back, to the states, we're going to take aggressive action. I give Governor Hochul and our state legislators credit for not wasting any time and taking up that challenge.
So do you have a general feeling that the court is not New York's friend?
I don't think the court singles New York out. You got some New Yorkers on the court as well on both sides. But I think in terms of policy issues, the court is implementing a conservative talking point agenda that is very troubling and very counter to most American sensibilities, not just New York. And it's really very concerning. And I think the impact of the Trump era and the Trump appointees is going to be felt for a long time to come. And it should be a wake-up call to everybody that when they're voting, how many times we say elections have consequences, especially come next presidential, should be a key issue as to what kind of folks are going to be appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. One thing you got to say about Trump, he had said what he was going to do. And he won anyway. And I think perhaps we had understated the risk of a Trump presidency in terms of the of the appointments to the Supreme Court. So it's an activist court, right? The old days, conservatives say the liberal activists are running the court. Well, now the conservative activists are running the court, and it's creating a lot of terrible consequences.
So have you been watching the January 6th hearings? I'm glued to them, and I wonder what you think.
I haven't been glued to them because, my day job keeps me busy, but it's beyond troubling, number one. But I do worry when I go out there and just talk in general. Is it moving anybody, or is it just confirming those that already were outraged at this and with those that were still supportive of the prior administration saying, well, they're making a big deal out of it that they shouldn't be? I don't have the answer to it, Alan. I hope it's moving people and opening people's eyes. I don't know that it is. I don't think any of us know at this point. Are there any implications in terms of what the U.S. Justice Department will do? Will any legal action be taken? I think it's too soon to tell. I have to say, unexpectedly, Liz Cheney is becoming a political heroine to me. You got to give her credit. I mean, given her pedigree and where she comes from, a very loyal Republican, and I've been on probably opposite sides of her on any number of issues or any number of candidates. And I got to tell you, she's probably sacrificing her own career in the Republican Party, but I would call her a patriot.
I think a lot has to do with her pop also. She comes from the Bush wing of the Republican Party, and I believe that's what's going on here. This is open warfare between the Bushies and Trump. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, yeah, you're right. But I'll also give her some credit that I just think she sat there and said, how could we stand for this? I mean, I give her credit that it's not just part of a political calculation. Because obviously, from what you hear, it doesn't seem like it's helping her in the polls in Wyoming, that's for sure. So, but she'll go down in history as someone who really stood up for what she believed in at great personal cost. So when you do your profiles, encourage number two to follow Jack Kennedy's book, have a chapter on Liz Cheney.
Whoever wrote it for Jack Kennedy, I hope they write it for me, too.
It was Madame Beerbaum, by the way. I think she was the ghostwriter.
She wrote it in French first. It had to be translated. In any case, it's great to talk to you, the wonderful controller of New York State, Tom DiNapoli, my friend and a guy who I much admire. Thanks so much for being with us, and we hope you'll come back again.
You bet. Thanks, Alan.